Do you weep when you hear All By Myself? Feel faint at the opening drumbeats of Like a Rolling Stone? Have you ever felt inclined to throttle the composer of one of those hilarious ringtones? The psychologists want to call these peak experiences, or better still, SEMs, strong experiences of music. They're moments, minutes even, when what is coming in through our ears has an effect that's completely overpowering. Mostly when the psychologists talk about SEMs, they'd like to come across people who mention Mahler and their experiences of the friskier moments of the Tenth Symphony. Mahler rather than, say, the Banshee, a 3-ounce acoustic grenade designed to disperse large, unwanted crowds with a peak experience-inducing 130 decibel squeal. From the trumpet sounded to blast down the walls of Jericho to that final horn stab that will signal the end of time, humans have and will always use sound to non-musical ends, like those high Cs of the high Cs produced by the treacherous sirens of ancient Greece. Ulysses had his sailors plug their ears with wax and tie him to the mast so that he could pass within earshot of the sound of the sirens without enduring the health and safety implications of hearing their cries. Would mere wax work for today's banshee acoustic grenades? Probably not. But whether the aim is to drive us onto the rocky coastline, stir the population to revolt, to keep the soldiers marching in time or force the enemy into surrender, there's always been a composer willing, delighted and honoured even, to take the king's, the queen's or the president's shilling. But find an effective tool for touching the human mind, and nearby you'll find not just an artist, but close behind a policeman, a soldier and a spook. This week on Sound Stories, our special guest is John Ronson, an English journalist who found himself investigating covert uses of sound when he began writing The Men Who Stare at Goats, his book about the American Army's Psychological Operations, or PSYOPS unit, and the enduring influence of something called the 1st Earth Battalion.
The 1st Earth Battalion was the brainchild of a man called Lieutenant Colonel Jim Channon, who was called the US Army's leading futurist, leading thinker into what the future of the US Army might hold. And it all began during the Vietnam War. Jim was leading a platoon of men, many of whom were killed, and he came to the conclusion that it was because the American soldier wasn't cunning. The American soldier would fire high, guilelessly, and miss the enemy, whereas the Viet Cong were sharpshooters and would shoot straight. So Jim survived Vietnam. And when he came back, he wrote to the Pentagon and said he wanted to go on a fact-finding mission to teach the US Army how to be more cunning. And the Pentagon, who were equally bruised by Vietnam, agreed. So they gave Jim funding, and he went off for 2 years to California. He had naked hot tub encounter sessions in Big Sur and primal arm wrestling and various different New Age endeavours in the emerging human potential movement of California in the 1980s. And after 2 years of this, he came back with this paper called the 1st Earth Battalion Operations Manual, which was a redesign of every aspect of US Army life. The soldier of the future would, instead of carrying a gun into battle, he'd carry a baby lamb. Now, if that wasn't enough to pacify the enemy, the soldier would have loudspeakers attached to his uniform, and these would emit indigenous music and words of peace. Jim got that particular idea, as far as I can tell, from meeting a New Age composer called Stephen Halpern, who lives in Northern California, who's one of the world's first ambient composers. Jim realised that music could be used to hit people on a psychic level, to kind of hit people's auras. So he thought music could be used in the battlefield. So if the indigenous music and the baby lambs and the sparkly eyes and the automatic hugs weren't enough to pacify an enemy, then the loudspeakers could be switched to broadcast discordant music such as acid rock out of sync. And if that wasn't enough, you could shoot the enemy. Also, the American soldier, all part of the manual, would be able to walk through walls and become invisible and kill things with the power of their mind. And the Pentagon read this paper and loved it. Found it very moving. They were so taken with Jim's ideas that they actually gave him the opportunity to create a real First Earth Battalion. They'd give him soldiers and these soldiers would try and walk through their walls. And Jim was rational enough to realise that this was not a good idea because they would be demanding results. And OK, it might look good on paper, but, you know, for walking through your wall wasn't necessarily an achievable skill in real life. So Jim said, no, I want this manual to be a notional unit.
So how did the ideas of that speculative pamphlet get turned into a sonic battle plan?
Jim wasn't the first person to think of using sound in the battlefield. In fact, I believe the British Army used white noise in Northern Ireland in the 1960s. And you could say that the walls of Jericho falling down were to do with noise. But as far as I can tell, and this has been confirmed to me by a number of generals and colonels who were around at the time, Jim was the very first person to introduce the idea of music as a weapon in US military intelligence. So that corner, special forces, intelligence, prisoner of war interrogation and so on. Jim introduced that idea. And that idea is very much alive today in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay. And the reason why we know this is all because of a Newsweek journalist called Adam Piori, who was embedded with psychological operations up in a place called Al-Qaim on the Iraq-Syrian border during the first wave of the war. And a soldier called Mark Hadsell said to Adam, go out to the back. This was this disused railway station that the Americans had taken over and were using as both a base and a prison. Go out to the back to where the shipping containers are. So Adam went out to the back and he saw what he described as a very weird disco. Because in one of these shipping containers, there was a young soldier with a strobe light flashing it on and off, on and off, on and off into the shipping container. And into the shipping container, he was blasting Metallica, Enter Sandman, and it was reverberating around the walls and driving whoever was in there insane. The soldier saw Adam looking and told him to go away. So Adam went away. And he mentioned this to Newsweek. And Newsweek said, we want a complete playlist. So Adam asked around and found out that the playlist of songs being blasted at Iraqi prisoners inside these shipping containers in Al-Qaim included Metallica, Matchbox 20, Barney the Purple Dinosaur singing the I Love You song, songs from Sesame Street, one or two others. So a strange gamut. Everything from Metallica to Barney.
If there's one thing Michael Moore's documentaries do for certain, it's encourage an underestimation of the intelligence of his opponents. All those NRA-loving, white-knuckle, gun-clutching, semi-literate, draft-dodging, good old boys out there, they're thick, aren't they? So why get all hot and bothered, then? John Ronson offers another version of the story, a version that suggests just 'cause you're crazy doesn't mean you're stupid.
I have a theory as to why they chose Barney, and it's a bit of a conspiracy theory, but it's one that's shared by Kenneth Roth, who's the head of Human Rights Watch. So it's good to share a conspiracy theory with somebody as rational as him. And it's that Barney was deliberately chosen because it seems funny that if America and the Western world heard that Iraqi prisoners were being blasted with the I Love You song by Barney, it would seem like a funny story, and we'd all go, Oh, we've had to listen to Barney too at 3 o'clock in the morning, those of us with children. Torture isn't that bad. And sure enough, for a little while, Barney became the funniest story of the war. It was everywhere. Even my own paper, The Guardian, which was, you know, very much against the war, ran funny stories about having to listen to Barney. Katie Couric, you know, one of the biggest TV hosts in America, made a big joke about it. Oh, you know, if Barney doesn't crack them, then they'll switch to the Teletubbies. And the internet was aflame with, well, you know, if Barney doesn't work, let's try Mariah Carey. So it became a funny story. And of course, when you've got a funny story, you don't want to replace it with a story that's not fun, because actually being put into a shipping container in the desert heat and blasted with a strobe light and the same song over and over again for whatever, 24, 48 hours, and maybe you're hanging upside down and maybe you've got a bag on your head, isn't funny. So I think PSYOPs are very clever. I think they did a bit of psychological operations on the West when they disseminated to Adam from Newsweek the Barney story.
When news broke that Barney was being used during interrogations of prisoners in Iraq, the double bluff seemed to be working extraordinarily well.
This is from the BBC news service, and it's headlined, "Heavy metal music and popular American children's songs are being used by U.S. interrogators to break the will of their captives in Iraq."
If the theme to PBS's Barney can't break you, it may be that nothing can. If the reliability of traditional channels of intelligence is in question, how about this for a novel idea? Enlist the help of Bert and Ernie.
When Metallica co-founder James Hetfield discovered that his band's hit Enter Sandman also featured on the PSYOP's Hot 100 playlist, the joke was still funny.
If I listen to, like, a death metal band, you know, for 12 hours in a row, I'd go insane. I'd tell you anything you wanted to know, you know? But, you know, Sesame Street can be pretty annoying,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, can you imagine Barney and Metallica? What?
Awesome. Well, there's our next tour in Iraq. That'd be awesome.
I love you, you love me, we're a happy family with a great big hug and a kiss from me to you. Won't you say you love me?
A song, like any work of art, will float free of its author, but it can turn up again in the most unexpected circumstances. Leonard Cohen recalls hearing someone singing Suzanne on a ferry in the Caspian Sea. Sesame Street composer Chris Cerf's experience was decidedly less romantic. When John Ronson went to New York City to meet Chris Cerf, the composer was surprised to discover his part in the US Army's psychological operations.
I approached many of the composers of the torture music. Most of them completely ignored me. But I did get a response from Christopher Cerf, who composes most of the incidental music for Sesame Street, who was kind of amazed to hear that his music was being used to torture people. He said it really wasn't what was intended. But then he worked out just how much royalty money he could get from the US military, because if it's being played on a loop and he gets 3 or 4 cents every time it's played on a loop, then he could be making thousands of dollars just from, you know, just from 3 or 4 shipping containers. So Christopher tried to get royalties from the US military.
How difficult is it to find a tone to tell that story in? Because, as you suggest, there's a kind of humour content that's very difficult to avoid, and then there's something really quite evil about it at the same time.
Well, something I like about this book of mine, The Menace Derek Goats, is that it starts as a slapstick comedy about US soldiers trying to kill goats just by staring at them and walking through their walls. And then Barney, as a torture technique, comes into it, and that seems funny too. But then slowly it begins to sour, like milk left on the mantelpiece. And you suddenly realise, actually, this isn't so funny. And so for me, structurally within the book, the Barney story is the moment when it really stops being funny. And Christopher Cerf, the Sesame Street composer, to his credit, was being both funny and not funny in his quest to get royalties from the US military.
But that bottle of milk is not sitting there curdling for no reason at all. It seems safe to presume that those who fund the PSYOPs unit of the US Army do not do so for a laugh, or indeed to produce yogurt. They hardly did it because they wanted the kudos of creating the funniest joke of the war. More likely, they believe playing loud music will help them achieve their aims. But will it? John has his doubts.
My guess is that blasting people with music isn't effective at all. The US military's got a long history of trying harebrained stuff out that just doesn't work. The same people who were inspired by the 1st Earth Battalion manual to walk through their walls and so on also invented a whole range of non-lethal weapons, none of which worked, like sticky foam, which would, you know, harden. Like in the Incredible Hulk movie, that was the one thing that could stop the Hulk for a while, was sticky foam. But I haven't come across any evidence that musical torture actually works. What it can do is drive somebody temporarily insane, but then you can't get coherent information out of them anyway.
Guantanamo failed to drive at least one British man crazy, though he did find the sound torture techniques employed there rendered him extremely curious. Jamal Al-Harith was a website designer from Manchester who was travelling on a tourist visa when he was arrested by the Taliban on suspicions of being a British spy. He was then taken by the Americans to Guantanamo Bay, as John Ronson explains.
I met an ex-Guantanamo detainee called Jamal Al-Harith, and he was blasted with Kris Kristofferson's Greatest Hits, an all-girl Fleetwood Mac cover band, well, that's how he described it, Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. I mean, he just basically said it didn't work. He said it was very weird. At one point, what they did with Jamal was they put him in a room and played him Fleetwood Mac at normal volume. And then when the CD was over, somebody would come in and put it back to the beginning and play it again. And he said he thought that was very odd indeed. And you know, they were looking at him through one of those, you know, one-way mirrors, just while he was being forced to listen to this music at normal volume. Now, again, I mean, it's impossible to substantiate, but one possible explanation for this is that they were trying to lace this music, this Fleetwood Mac and Kris Kristofferson, with other sounds, maybe silent sounds or high and low frequencies. I said to Jamal, how does it feel, you know, being at Guantanamo Bay? He said it felt like being a guinea pig. He said it felt like being a golden opportunity to try stuff out on. So my guess is that these exotic techniques, like music and frequencies and subliminal sounds, come to life at places like Guantanamo Bay because they're basically like experimental interrogation labs where all these ideas that have floated around in military think tanks like the 1st Earth Battalion, suddenly they get an opportunity to flourish. They just try them out. That's what they did at Waco with the Branch Davidians. They were trying out all sorts of exotic techniques, including silent sounds. They were going to get a Russian scientist to lace subliminally under Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking," they were going to lace the voice of God subliminally telling David Koresh to surrender. And apparently they'd already signed up Charlton Heston to play the voice of God. And the reason why this didn't happen was because the scientist, a Russian scientist called Igor Smirnov, who invented the technique, the US Army wanted him to take full responsibility if anything went wrong. And he said no. And so they didn't try it out. But they seriously considered trying out these subliminal technologies at Waco, because yet again, it's like a golden opportunity to try all these different techniques out, like a casserole of ideas.
John's dedication for the men who stare at goats includes a shout out to General Stubblebine, one of the key figures in the 1st Earth Battalion. But were his relations with all those featured in the book quite as cordial?
Well, I've had a whole gamut of responses from the people in the Men Who Stare at Goats. Some of them are very happy with the way they've been portrayed. Some are really cross. One or two of them denied ever meeting me, even though I filmed them, because I put it out. I put the corresponding series out on Channel 4. The people who are glad are the people who are proud of what they tried out, because blasting people with Barney, even if they do it in a grotesque way, is not as bad as killing somebody. And at the root of the 1st Earth Battalion was, let's find a way to stamp out killing. Let's find a way of fighting wars without killing. Hence their attempts to walk through their walls and blast people with subliminal sounds and so on, sound weapons. So the pragmatists behind these paranormal techniques are proud, rightly in some ways, of their good-heartedness. But you don't want a good-hearted endeavour to be the sanctioning of torture.
Of course, perhaps Sesame Street is not really that strange a choice for brainwashing. After all, don't all those tales aimed at children have subliminal messages, from Hans Christian Andersen all the way to SpongeBob SquarePants? But when it comes to withering assessments of the brainwashing powers of Sesame Street, there could hardly be anyone who sees them more clearly than one of the street's composers, Chris Cerf. John Ronson here reads us the passage from his book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, in which he meets the mischievous composer of Das Is Ein Mountain and other timeless kindergarten classics.
Christopher Cerf has been composing songs for Sesame Street for 25 years. His large Manhattan townhouse is full of Sesame Street memorabilia, photographs of Christopher with his arm around Big Bird, etc. "Well, it's certainly not what I expected when I wrote them," Christopher said. "I have to admit, my first reaction was, 'Oh my gosh, is my music really that terrible?' I laughed. 'I once wrote a song for Bert and Ernie called Put Down the Ducky,' he said, 'which might be useful for interrogating members of the Bath Party.' 'That's very good,' I said. 'This interview,' Christopher said, 'has been brought to you by the letters W, M and D.' We both laughed. I paused. 'And do you think that the Iraqi prisoners, as well as giving away vital information, are learning new letters and numbers?' I said. 'Well, wouldn't that be an incredible double win?' said Christopher. Christopher took me upstairs to his studio. He played me one of his Sesame Street compositions called Ya Ya Das Is a Mountain. 'The way we do Sesame Street,' he explained, 'is that we have educational researchers who test whether these songs are working, whether the kids are learning. And one year they asked me to write a song to explain what a mountain is, and I wrote a really silly yodeling song about what a mountain was.' Christopher sang me a little of the song. 'Umpapa, umpapa, ya, ya, das is a mountain, part of the ground that sticks way up high.' Anyway,' he said, 40% of the kids had known what a mountain was before they heard the song, and after they heard the song, only about 26% knew what a mountain was. That's all they needed. You don't know what a mountain is now, right? It's gone. So I figure if I have the power to suck information out of people's brains by writing these songs, maybe that's something that could be useful to the CIA for brainwashing techniques."
John Ronson there. And to conclude this final programme, we've been joined in the Sound Stories studio by many of the contributors to the series for a last curtain call. So for one last time, the hippos of the Masai Mara. The migrating knot of Norfolk.
the carriages of Chihuahua train station, the Vatnajökull Glacier. The singing traffic of Manhattan. Heston Blumenthal munching a gherkin. The granite voice of Sylvia Plath.
Come here, sweetie, out of the closet. Well, what do you think of that? Naked as paper to start, but in 25 years she'll be silver, in 50, gold. A living doll everywhere you look. It can sew, it can cook, it can talk.
The fabulous Miss Lena Lamont.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
Can't.
The inimitable Emira Baraka.
Yes, the pain in dreams comes again. Race pain. People are people everywhere. Yeah, ooh, yeah. Our people, yes, people, every people, most people, ooh, yeah. Most people in pain.
The magic choppers of Apocalypse Now. A one-sided phone conversation. The early morning revelers of South Dublin. And the sea lapping at Brighton's West Pier. From all of us at Sound Stories, goodbye.